From Kiev to Caracas, today, Friday, February 21st, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. Ukraine and Venezuela have been gripped by popular protests this week. We'll get the latest from both places. Plus, as the Winter Olympics draw to a close, a veteran foreign correspondent weighs in on the future of Sochi, which hopes to host future events.
Can, you know, one Formula One race and one World Cup and a couple of conventions turn this thing into such a big draw that it will justify all the money that's spent on it?
Also, an Irish woman sparks outrage on Twitter when she publicly discusses getting an abortion.
People were disgusted and appalled, and it was shocking and it was horrible. And all I'd said was, I'm pro-choice and I've had an abortion.
And speaking of Twitter, we'll check out the massively popular account of Spain's National Police Force.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's been a week of grim news from Ukraine. Dozens have died or have been injured in clashes between police and protesters demanding change. But there were a couple pieces of good news for Ukrainians today. The country won its first gold at the Sochi Olympics in the women's biathlon relay. And the violence in Ukraine itself seems to have died down. President Viktor Yanukovych appears to have blinked in his confrontation with the protest movement. He made a series of concessions in a deal with opposition leaders.
Чим я вас усіх і поздравляю.
So they're cheering and singing the national anthem in the Ukrainian parliament. But what about out on the street? Margaret Evans has been out all day in downtown Kiev reporting for the CBC. Margaret, what's it been like today?
Well, outside of the square and inside of the square are two very different things here. When the news broke that the deal had actually been signed by opposition leaders, I was a few blocks outside the square. And, you know, a few people were honking their horns, things like that. But in the square, I didn't meet a single person who was happy that the deal had been signed. They don't think it goes far enough. You know, they've always said, we're not going until Yanukovych actually resigns, and nothing seems to have changed that.
So what kind of deal was struck today?
Well, there are a couple of different aspects to it. I think the most important for the opposition is that there is agreement to revert to the 2004 constitution, which really diminishes the power of the president, giving more power back to the parliament. So it's taken away some of the powers that Yanukovych has given himself over the years. Then there will be a coalition government fairly quickly and presidential elections no later than December of this year. So it's quite far-reaching. But again, I didn't meet a single person on the square who said it went far enough. People say that they don't trust him. They think that this is the hand of Russia. They didn't like the fact that there was a Russian envoy in the discussions. They see it as a time-buying tactic, if you like. They all call President Yanukovych a bandit, and they simply think that he'll use this to gather his resources again, and that they'll just be back in the same place a few months later.
Wasn't there also an agreement today that they're going to release the former president Yulia Tymoshenko from prison?
The parliament basically decriminalized the count that she was originally charged on, which would allow them to release her from jail, although it's not clear to me yet whether or not the president has to sign off on that. But essentially, they did take a vote, which means that the parliament agrees that she should be allowed to go free.
So the protesters that you talked to, you couldn't find anybody who supported this deal. What would please the protester? What do they want to see in a deal before they accept it?
It's very, very simple in their mind. They simply want President Yanukovych to resign immediately. They want him gone yesterday. And I think that, you know, what we're going to be watching for in the hours and days to come is how committed the conventional opposition leaders are to selling this deal to the people who've been spending the nights in the square, the ones who've been manning the barricades, the hardcore people who've been, you know, engaging in clashes with the riot police. And, you know, nobody says that they're going to leave the square. I did meet a few people who said they're happy if this de-escalates the tension. They're happy if there are no more deaths. But I'm not sure that this is going to be enough to actually empty the square of the people. I mean, today they were still, you know, manning chain gangs, bricking up the barricades. They're still fortifying the barriers.
Viktor Yanukovych has made concessions before, and then he's welched on the deal. What guarantees are there that he won't do that again?
Well, it's hard to say about guarantees. I mean, I think that the dismissal of the interior minister is important in real terms and symbolically as well, because it does seem to be at least the start of a dismantling of the power structure around President Yanukovych. But people are very nervous that there will be backsliding. They're nervous about what the reaction of Moscow will be once the distraction of the Sochi Olympics is gone. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and that's what, you know, one young man said to me today. He can still do whatever he wants to us.
CBC's Margaret Evans in Kiev. Thanks, Margaret.
You're welcome, Carol.
We're turning to Venezuela now, where anti-government protesters and police have also been clashing this week with deadly results. In the year since the death of President Hugo Chavez, the country's been facing massive shortages and hyperinflation. And now the government faces a swelling opposition movement. Journalist Andrew Rosati is in Caracas and has been following the demonstrations.
The protesters are mainly middle-class university students. They started in the western side of the country, but have swelled in recent weeks, especially getting backed by a prominent opposition leader, Leopoldo López. Since his backing, scores of critics of the government have joined, but the motor of all the protest movements are the students.
So it seems to have started in this western city, San Cristobal. And Leopoldo López, I read he's a descendant of Simón Bolívar?
Yes, he says he's a descendant of Simón Bolívar. He comes from a very wealthy elite family in Caracas. What he has done, what other opposition leaders haven't done, is that he has said it is necessary to go to the streets in peaceful protest. Two-time presidential candidate Enrique Capriles, who has been the de facto leader of the opposition, has been pushing for a dialogue with the government. However, many are fed up and feel that they can't wait for another wave of elections. So the hardliners, like Leopoldo López and many of these students, want action now, so they're in the streets.
But Leopoldo López was arrested, so he's not on the streets. But these protests have turned violent. What's driving them to the point of violence?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors there. One is a lot of people are very fed up with the situation in the country. There's over 56% inflation. Last year, the country saw almost 25,000 murders, making it one of the most dangerous countries in the world. And there's rampant shortages of basic foods like sugar, milk, and even toilet paper is hard to find here. So all that combined with an atmosphere where the government has come out with National Guardsmen, and these groups feel that they are not allowed to execute their constitutional right, which is a peaceful protest. So this has resulted with students responding, throwing rocks, at times Molotov cocktails, and the government responding with rubber bullets and tear gas, and the whole thing just escalates very fast. Also, when the first peaceful protest began, a student was killed by a gunshot. And since then, it just spiraled. There was a lot of anger. A lot of students took to mild rioting, throwing rocks at government buildings and damaging a lot of private property.
What does this mean for Nicolas Maduro? He really inherited the mantle of Hugo Chavez. Where does this leave him?
Well, this is the most serious unrest he has seen since starting his presidency last April. President Nicolas Maduro won by a very, very slim margin, less than 2 percentage points. So a lot of the protesters feel that they have a really good chance of seeking change. Now, Hugo Chavez constantly won elections by a very large margin. On top of that, the inflation and the crime are the worst they've been in years here. So everything is kind of coming to a head at once in Venezuela.
Now, military police have been using some unusual tactics to disrupt the protesters, including shutting down the internet.
This is creating even more unrest. We were hearing reports that in western Venezuela, where these protests really started, the interior minister announced that he sent in 3,000 troops yesterday. And on top of that, local journalists are reporting that they have not had any cell phone signal. They have no internet connection, and at times even been without electricity. one of the things they're saying is the government is doing this because Venezuelans are very active on social media. They're very active on the internet. And since a lot of major news networks have been silenced over the years under Hugo Chavez, Venezuelans have been getting in touch and getting the word out through things like Twitter, circulating images, or getting in touch with colleagues, telling them when to protest. So they are saying this is a way for the government to kind of silence the opposition in these areas and hoping that this protest movement will peter out there.
Reporter Andrew Rosati in Caracas, thanks for your update.
Thank you.
Well, the protests in Venezuela are reverberating in the classical music world. Gustavo Dudamel is the Wunderkind conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and he's Venezuelan. Now he finds himself under pressure to take a stand on what's going on back home. Dudamel is the most public face of Venezuela's El Sistema. It's the country's famed national music education program. Dudamel retains close ties to El Sistema and its orchestra, which happens to be performing in Los Angeles this evening. Mark Swed is the music critic for the Los Angeles Times. He says the pressure on Dudamel started with a rumor.
There were some erroneous reports that Dudamel had been performing at a celebration with President Nicolas Maduro on February 12th, the first day in which the demonstrations became violent and three people were killed. In fact, those reports were completely erroneous. Dudamel was conducting a children's orchestra from his hometown, Barquisimeto, but people thought that this was Dudamel implicitly giving approval of the government. And with all of the charges of human rights violations going on right now in Venezuela and the huge unrest, there are people who are asking him to speak out.
Now, today, Friday, the Simon Bolivar Symphony Orchestra of Venezuela is performing in Los Angeles this evening. I assume Gustavo Dudamel will be there. And I understand some Venezuelan protesters are planning to attend as well. Who are they?
The people I have heard from are Venezuelan immigrants. There's a lot of emotion right now, and I'm sure there will be something at Disney Hall. Dudamel will be conducting this concert, and from my understanding, there will be a demonstration outside, but it's not unusual to have a demonstration at a concert.
When you spoke to Dudamel earlier this week, does he seem frustrated by all this?
He seems adamant. I'm sure he must be frustrated. The impression I got is he is adamant about protecting El Sistema, that it's what he believes in, and that this program needs to continue and needs to be as separated from politics as he can possibly make it.
Why does he think that taking a stand or speaking out is going to threaten El Sistema?
It's funded by the government. I think that that's their big concern.
But it also seems to have weathered every political stripe in Venezuela during its 30-plus history.
Yeah, and I think it's weathered it because of that very attitude.
Gustavo Dudamel is sort of a phenomenon himself. Tell us a bit about him.
He grew up in the El Sistema system. Dudamel, who was a violinist in one of the children's orchestras in his hometown of Barquisimeto, was recognized to have a talent as a conductor and was nurtured. And he has proven to have a very rare and very great talent and grew up through that whole system and has become now probably one of the two or three largest stars in classical music and almost a household name.
And he's all of 33. And he named conductor of the LA Philharmonic when he was all of maybe 28?
That's true. All of that is true, yes. By the time he was in his very early 20s, he was already recognized as quite a phenomenon.
Well, I suspect Gustavo Dudamel is going to continue to be dogged by this because it doesn't look like these protests are going away. And so we hope to catch up with you another time about that. Mark Swed is the music critic for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Mark.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at medtronicphilanthropy.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. A couple of stories now about Twitter. First, one from Spain. The country's cops have embraced Twitter as a means of community policing. Behind the National Police Force's Twitter account is one man armed only with a smartphone. The World's Jerry Haddon went to Madrid to meet him.
The Twitter guy at Spain's National Police is Carlos Fernandez. He claims his force is now the most followed in the world, surpassing even the FBI.
756,000 en Twitter.
We now have 756,000 Twitter followers, he says. Actually, this interview is from a few days ago. Total following is now up to 767,000. The FBI has about 40,000 fewer.
Le superamos hace 10 días, pero es anecdótico.
It is more than the FBI's, but that's just anecdotal, he says. The most important thing is the service we provide. We're useful. The communication goes both ways. Citizens give back, he says. They cooperate. For example,
muy positivo. Hemos buscado a tres fugitivos, y esos tres
just this January, we were looking for three fugitives. The last was still on the loose. I sent out just one single tweet with the guy's photo. It got retweeted 6,300 times. It ended up reaching 4 million people. We started getting calls and emails, which led us to the guy. We arrested him. Fernandez has been at this for 5 years. He can rattle off dozens of other examples. There was the case of the predator dwarf drugging and assaulting women, the breakup of a ring of pedophiles sharing child porn online. But sometimes it's not about arresting anyone.
Fue el pedido de donación de sangre para el accidente ferroviario de Santiago.
The most shared tweet I ever sent out, he says, was when I asked for volunteer blood donors after the high-speed train crash in Galicia last year. It got retweeted 17,000 times. Fernandez says the trick is not acting like a cop, which he's actually not. He's a marketing guy. On staff, but not an officer. I always try to think from the public's point of view, he says, because if we're just staring at our own belly buttons, people will lose interest. For example, yesterday, the director of the police paid a visit to the commissary in the city of Lérida. I didn't tweet that. Why? Because it wasn't
divertido o interesante o útil.
Funny, interesting, or useful. Fernandez says another key is his offbeat, hip tone. Coming from the police, it shocks people. Then they click the follow button. Here's an example.
Si juegas a Breaking Bad,
if you play at Breaking Bad, you'll end up on the set of Prison Break. If you mess with drugs, it's gonna end badly. That one got 12,000 retweets. Fernandez says he sees himself as the Starsky or Hutch of social media. But all this has rankled a few among the ranks who fear Fernandez is undermining their reputation for authority. Some 2 or 3% of the force don't like it, he says. They say, Carlos, remember, we're the police. The rest are on board, though. But it took a while. As to whether the huge Twitter following translates into better police relations on the street, Fernandez says he hears anecdotally from officers that it does. And it helps to remember that just a generation ago, under the dictator Francisco Franco, Spain's national police were generally feared. You probably would have thought twice before sharing 140-character messages with them. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Madrid.
And on another Twitter note, we head to Ireland, as in the Twitter feed, at Ireland. The government doesn't run it, Irish people do. A new user takes the reins each week. The feed has more than 20,000 followers. All those followers got a jolt when Janet Nuhulurwan started tweeting. First she tweeted she was pro-choice. Then she tweeted more. In a burst of tweets, she told the story of quietly traveling to England to get an abortion when she was 18. Abortion's illegal in Ireland, except in limited cases. Soon Janet's tweets went viral. She joins us from Dublin. Janet, can you tell us how you came to be involved with the At Ireland Twitter feed?
I follow the At Ireland account myself. And around November, there was a very conservative neoliberal person had the reins for the week. And I didn't agree with a lot of their views. And the point was made out to me that anybody can apply to curate At Ireland. So I sent it an email and my application was accepted. And then I got asked, would I do the week of the 10th to the 17th? So I was delighted.
Why did you start to tell your story?
Well, I started tweeting at 8 a.m. on Monday, and I didn't actually mention that I was even pro-choice up until Thursday afternoon. I wanted to talk about passion and people's interests and passion. Then on Thursday, the Irish Family Planning Association had been tweeting from their accounts. about the safer sex workshops they were running in colleges. So I had retweeted them and got a bunch of tweets back from people condemning the Irish Family Planning Association. There was enough of them that I got cross. So I tweeted it generally just to let people know I am pro-choice. I had an abortion myself and I work with the Abortion Rights Campaign. And I left it at that and I went off and cooked dinner. But the tweets kept coming. People were disgusted and appalled and it was shocking and it was horrible. And all I'd said was, I'm pro-choice and I've had an abortion. So I got some friends of mine to be online for some moral support. And I decided I would tell my story because women who have abortions in Ireland don't tend to talk about them. We don't hear stories from women like me who decided I wasn't ready to be a parent. I wasn't ready to have a baby.
How has making this public and tweeting it and getting responses affected you?
Well, I have to say 90% of the responses I've had have been very supportive. People saying that I'm very brave, people happy to hear my story. People saying it's nice to hear from somebody who made that choice. It's nice to hear from somebody who doesn't regret, who doesn't couch their experience in traumatic language, because I'm unrepentant about the fact that I had an abortion. It was the right decision for me and I refused to be shamed about it. Some of the most touching tweets I got back were from other women and all they said was thank you. Just those two words, but they conveyed so much meaning.
Are attitudes towards abortions changing at all in Ireland?
They are. July 2012, there was a lot of money was spent on a national billboard campaign from the anti-abortion lobby. And the sign said, abortion always tears her life apart. And this was on billboards, it was on buses, it was on public transport. And it made a lot of people very angry because it didn't tear my life apart. It gave me back over my life and my future and what I wanted to do. So we ended up with a lot of very angry people discussing online. And then I went to a pro-choice meeting. And I found myself in a room with 40 pro-choice people. I'd never been in a room with so many pro-choice people, all of them not being afraid to say they're pro-choice. And from that, then, over the next couple of months, the Abortion Rights Campaign was formed.
What do you hope your tweets will accomplish?
If it's made one person who's made that journey feel less bad about it, then I'd be happy with that. If it means that one person can tell a friend or even their husband, there are women who've gotten married and have children and their husbands don't know that they had an abortion. If it makes somebody in a crisis pregnancy situation who wants to have an abortion but doesn't know if they can get the money to get to travel or if they can face that journey, if my sharing my experience makes it a little bit easier for them, then I'm happy.
We've been speaking with Janet Nuhularan from Dublin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can read through the tweets where Janet tells the story of her journey to the UK for an abortion. We've pulled them together in a Twitter timeline. That's at PRI.org. I'm Carol Hills. Ahead on the world, a food writer sits down to sample Quebec's heart attack on a plate. It's called poutine.
French fries, cheese curds, and this dark, rich beef and chicken stock-based gravy. I've got my Lipitor, so I'm in good shape.
Whew, crisis averted. Plus, tackling the mean streets of Beirut as a bike messenger.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Much was made in the run-up to the Sochi Olympics about security and the so-called Ring of Steel surrounding the Games. And now as we head into the final weekend of the Games, we wanted to take stock of just how that's gone. So we called on journalist David Filipov in the Sochi Press headquarters. He's been reporting on security in Sochi for the Boston Globe. I asked him plainly, has the security apparatus in Sochi worked?
Well, so far, fingers crossed, it has. And I'd say it was an obsession of the world. I mean, the State Department was putting out alerts. Russia was showing these lurid pictures of Black Widows into Sochi and, you know, wanted persons posters. Inside the Ring of Steel, augmented by a long line of Zeppelins that kind of go along the coast, you've got a lot of ships in the water. You have 100,000 security troops. You've got all these checkpoints and everything. Inside the bubble, yeah, it's gone really well. And what is striking is that despite the warnings, nobody has so far done anything outside the bubble.
Is there any information on whether all that security foiled some real threats that happened and we just don't know about them?
There's two ways of looking at this. One is that the ring around the Olympic Park, so great, you know, nobody could get through it. And everybody knows that the actual getting into the park is pretty thorough. Either our terrorists out there didn't want to attack civilian objects, or they just couldn't get here, or they don't have the logistics even to get out of Dagestan in the woods, wherever they are.
What will we remember about what's been dubbed Putin's Olympics?
What will be remembered is that, you know, they came off. There will be athletic performances that people are going to remember. The question was, can Putin pull off an Olympics, and can Russia get it all together to do a flashy kind of modern take on this time-honored tradition? And yeah, they pulled that off. The question of what's going to come next is a different question altogether. And what's happening in Ukraine is also a different question. It steals headlines from Putin and his attempt to show Russia, but it is a different country. And Ukrainians have gone out of their way to make it clear that they're a different country. So it isn't something that's happening in Russia.
What about Sochi itself? A lot of money has been pumped into it. I'm sure at least Putin has plans for it post-Olympics. What are the prospects for the city?
The thing is that what was always wrong about Sochi is still wrong. The thing has been built under sea level, below sea level. What's protecting the land from the sea is a thin barrier of rocks and stones that used to be deposited by the rivers, which have been clogged up by the construction. So the erosion of that bank keeps going. One or two really big storms, and they have them here, and you could see the entire Olympic area underwater. That's always been the problem here. When they built these heavy, massive buildings on this swamp, all of the sort of expert work and all the analysis and all the studies, that was kind of hurried through. There were no sort of community meetings where they said, you know, is this what you guys want? And that was all because Putin's order was get this thing going, show Russians great ability to put one of these together. And he's done it. But he built this thing on a swamp, and he built it in the middle of nowhere. Sochi has 450,000 people. They have a mall, and it's two-thirds empty. There's still a floor where there are no shops. So one of the big draws to Sochi is supposed to be this big mall that they're going to build. But 30,000 people live in this part of Sochi. 450,000 live in the part that already has the mall no one goes to. So the question I have is, how are they going to get people to come out here to this thing, which has been built in this place where you shouldn't build big things? That's really the issue here. The big plans that they have for it and the venues that they've built, that all might be well and good, but the question is, can, you know, one Formula One race and one World Cup and a couple of conventions turn this thing into such a big draw that it will justify all the money that's spent on it?
Finally, David, you've been at the Games for 2 weeks now, and I can't leave you without asking, what's been the highlight of your time there?
The thing that actually has really impressed me, and I kept trying to not find it, I went looking for Russian fans who didn't care. And wherever I went, the poorest, most, you know, neglected places up in the mountains where none of the Olympic benefit came, you see people sitting there cheering for their team, proud of Russia, proud of the fact that they could pull this off. I mean, it was in a village where they don't have running water. They were promised it. They don't have gas. They were promised that. And they're glued to the TV. And one of the people there said, I have pride in my country, even though this is the way that I live. What happens in Russia reflects on me, and I'm proud of it. And wow, that got me.
David Filipov, he's been reporting in Sochi for the Boston Globe. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks for having me.
And one final Olympic note, just my two cents. Most of the people in the world's newsroom are Summer Olympic snobs. They think the Winter Olympics are small and cold, and they just don't get it. Those of us who had snowy childhoods or come from wintry countries like Canada, we're the ones who've been sneaking in some live-streamed events from Sochi, between assignments, of course, and occasionally letting out a hoop or a holler. So here's my hoop and holler, Michaela Schifrin. She's American, and she made alpine skiing history today as the youngest person, male or female, to win an Olympic gold in slalom. Schifrin is 18, and she's a slalom champ, having won every possible slalom award this season. To the uninitiated, slalom is the less sexy event to the Super G or downhill, which are all about speed. Slalom is a technical discipline and one of the oldest in the Winter Olympics. Yes, it's still about finding the shortest way down the hill by going through lots of gates set close to one another. So close, in fact, that you have to shift your weight, set your edges, and turn your skis about once a second, or less. Michaela Schifrin learned how to turn quickly and fast by running as many gates as she could and then running some more. She mastered the technique. Congratulations, Michaela. And now from skiing to cycling, let's go to Lebanon. The capital, Beirut, is not exactly what you'd call bicycle-friendly. But that hasn't stopped entrepreneurs from launching a new business, delivery via bike messenger. Susanna George reports.
Being a bike messenger is already a dangerous job. But here in Beirut, chaotic takes on a whole new meaning. Roads are narrow and poorly maintained. There are traffic lights, but drivers ignore most of them. People go the wrong way on one-way streets. Double or triple parking is commonplace. Often people are just stopping to chat. And lane markings, they're more or less suggestions. But where the uninitiated may see chaos, Dogri bike messengers see opportunity. Sitting with a laptop and a map, Matt Saunders, the co-founder of Dogri, takes calls and dispatches his team. He says traffic is actually one of the things that makes Beirut a good city for bike messengers.
You have big congestion problems and, you know, unpredictable traffic jams. It just, you know, paralyzes the whole city, so the bike is perfect for that. You just get through. So the choice of the bike for deliveries is just, for me, it was obvious.
And the name, Dogri?
We went through lots of different possible names, like Yalla Messengers, or Lightning Messengers, or Flash Courier, stuff like that. At the end, we both just came back to Dogri. It means straight on, or right now, kind of thing, so straight on or right away.
The irony is that nothing in Lebanon is Dogri. Mohamed Shablak's been a messenger with the company since it was founded last year and was biking in Beirut long before that. Of course, riding here is treacherous, he says, but Beirut can be a dangerous place for anyone for a lot of reasons.
There is a risk in doing, even in walking in inside the city. It's not that calm city, and it's not Copenhagen or Portland.
So have you ever been hit?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I was car doored 4 months ago, and I have stitches on my hand. I usually have bruises on my legs. It's okay. So it's part of the deal. Everyone can be hit and fall on the ground.
Also part of the deal, people with guns. So Shablak says you have to think twice before getting angry with drivers.
You don't want to lose your ride. At the same time, you don't want to get killed or being shot because you don't know who you are dealing with. You don't know. You don't know. I mean, there is gun. There is guns. People have guns and people can use it. And like sometimes I feel drivers here defend themselves against the cyclist as if it was their life on stake. I mean, they forget that they are in a huge metallic box and they're protected and we have our legs out there. And they defend themselves in like crazy way that I can't argue with that. I mean, yeah.
But beyond the traffic and the guns, bike messengers also have to deal with the fact that there aren't any street addresses in Beirut. The streets have names, but the residents rarely use them, even if they know them. Shablak says messengers can take up to a page of notes for each delivery.
People mention the area, then what kind of shop there is to the right corner, and you will find a red car there. Then you have to ask about, that person who will give you the address of, you know, it's a complicated way, but that's how things are done here.
I asked Shablak if he wishes Beirut would become a more bike-friendly city, like Portland or Copenhagen.
I don't know. I haven't cycled in a bike lane city, so I can't imagine that. I hear it's boring.
For the world, I'm Susanna George in Beirut.
Now we're going to slow things down a bit.
2:36 for four, and in comes Harris again, and works on the back foot, playing that to mid-off and Rogers Fields, and there is no run.
That's Henry Blofeld covering a cricket match for BBC Radio.
Isn't it strange? The pigeons have come in again. They did this late yesterday. I don't know whether there's sort of seed that suddenly appears late on. But
it's not the NFL, that's for sure. Henry Blofeld is a voice from a bygone age. Here's the world's Alex Gallifant.
At school in England, Henry Blofeld was a talented cricketer, perhaps set for greatness. That is, until June 1957, when, after a match, he was run over by a bus. Blofeld lay unconscious for almost a month.
That rather messed my cricket up. Blood was gushing out of my mouth, but my head was in a fair state. I mean, I had something like 18 major brain operations. And they always tell me that I was very lucky. I was lucky to live, but I was particularly lucky not to become a cabbage. Although, of course, there are some of my charming friends who say otherwise. Anyway.
Blofeld is now 74 years old. For cricket fans, he's a larger-than-life character, like he's jumped out of a novel by P.G. Wodehouse. For a start, Blofeld was born with an enormous silver spoon in his mouth.
There were masses of staff, servants, as they were called in those days. I mean, nannies, nursery maids. I practically never had meals with my parents till I was 14.
You get the picture. Blofeld grew into an eminently social man, always with an anecdote to hand. Like, there's the time he met Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe.
I remember two things about him. One was he was an Olympic class. He'd have won a gold medal for spitting over the medium and long range. I was forever ducking, and they were going over my right shoulder, and then ducking again, it was going over my left shoulder. Added to which, he had just about the nastiest and worst halitosis I've ever got near to, if you see what I mean.
Then there's the time he met James Bond author Ian Fleming. Blofeld, along with his father and brother, belonged to a gentleman's club in London called Boodles. Fleming was a member too. Fleming recalled trying to come up with a name for the villain in his Bond novel, Thunderball.
And he said, I went to bed scratching my head, which is not always the best way of getting to sleep, and woke up more or less similarly afflicted, and couldn't think of it in the morning, and got a taxi to Boodles and St. James's Street, and sank gratefully into a leather armchair, reached for the membership list, and started to go through it alphabetically, looking for the name of a baddie, and when he got to the B's, he was gobsmacked by a phalanx of three Blofelds. And in his own words, he said, I slammed the book shut, gave a yelp of delight, ordered a pint of champagne and never looked back.
The villain, of course, was Ernst Stavro Blofeld. In the movies, he's the bald guy with the white cat.
As you see, I am about to inaugurate a little war. In a matter of hours, when America and Russia have annihilated each other, we shall see a new power dominating the world. Target
vehicle on screen. One more story. In 1976, Henry Blofeld was scheduled to go to India to watch cricket. He decided to drive there, from London to Bombay.
And we collected five people, and one of them owned a 1921 Silver Ghost Rolls-Royce, the most perfect claret-coloured machine.
And off they went in the Rolls-Royce through Europe and beyond, on to Afghanistan, Iran, and then Pakistan.
And then after we got through the Khyber Pass, we went down to Peshawar and stayed, I remember, at Dean's Hotel, which is one of those famous old hotels the English had a habit of leaving behind them.
From there, it was a hop, skip and a jump over the border into India and onto Bombay.
It took us 46 days and nights, and we always said we'd get there on the 22nd of November in time for lunch, and we sat down to lunch at 1:45, which wasn't bad.
A monumental effort culminating in lunch. That gets to the heart of Blofeld's appeal, I think. He represents an idealized version of the upper-class Englishman of yesteryear. A mixture of adventure and refinement, of understatement and jolly good fun.
I regard each day as an orange that has to have as much juice squeezed out of it as possible. And when I finish squeezing one day's orange, I go to bed and wait for the next day's orange. I'm all for getting the maximum of fun out of life and having as much laughter as I can. We none of us laugh enough. We live in a gloomy age, and when you do laugh, you feel better.
Indeed you do. And so, for as long as Henry Blofeld's on the radio, I'll be listening. For The World, I'm Alex Gallifant.
Well, do you think that's that all right? Have I talked a modicum of sense, do you think? I don't suppose so. I seldom do.
All right, then. I've been sitting in the hosting chair all week, but next week I'll dive back into my job here at The World as our cartoons editor. Political cartoonists have a way of condensing the big news stories like Ukraine and Venezuela into biting visual comments that can make you laugh, sigh, and occasionally gasp. Check out some of the cartoons I've been posting this week. Just follow me on Twitter, at Global Cartoons or on our Tumblr. Find us at pritheworld.tumblr.com.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. It could be Canada's best-kept secret. This side of the border, we have chili fries and curly fries, but that's about as jazzed as our fries get. Up north, well, they like to smother their fries in gravy and a healthy helping of cheese curds. Yum. It's called poutine, and it's something of a national dish, celebrated every year at this time with La Poutine Week. Food reporter Steve Dolinsky has been hunkered down at La Banquise in Montreal. It's one of over 100 restaurants across Canada that have thrown down their best poutine dish this week. Steve, I understand the big hit this year is reggae poutine. What is that?
Yeah, reggae poutine is a bit of a lost in translation item, actually, here at La Banquise, which is a legendary restaurant here in the Plateau. It's got guacamole, tomatoes, banana peppers, ground beef, on top of the typical cheese curds and gravy. So it really, it's more of a Mexican olé poutine as opposed to a reggae poutine. I didn't see any jerk chicken on here, but apparently one of the cooks likes reggae music and decided to call it a reggae poutine.
Sounds kind of rich. How are you holding up so far, Steve?
I've got my Lipitor, so I'm in good shape. There's the regular poutine in front of me, which is just the standard, you know, the French fries, the cheese curds, and this dark, rich beef and chicken stock-based gravy. Super interesting dish, though. You know, you think, oh, it's just fries and gravy and cheese, but the curds have to be fresh. They're delivered every morning. They've got to have a little squeak to them. They've got to have a little bit of a chew. They're not, they should not melt. Like people think, oh, cheese and gravy, it's going to melt all over the fries. They've got to actually stand on their own and be sort of individual curds. You can kind of chew into them. The fries, I thought Idaho russets, right? Or maybe Kennebecs, but these are red potatoes. They like them for their sweetness, apparently. And they twice fry them. They blanch them a little bit to cook the inside. And as I said, the gravy, it's got to be both chicken stock and beef stock with some flour to thicken it and lots of black pepper.
So what are you eating right now?
I'm a purist. I like the simple poutine that's sitting in front of me. And by the way, as an American, I say poutine, but the locals here say it's poutine, like the Russian leader. And the plain one is really nice. I like this. It's a white cheddar curd, and it does have a little bit of a snap, a chew, kind of a squeakiness to it. And it's just such a perfect dish for winter. Right now, here in the middle of February, coming into March in Montreal, they just had this poutine week, and everybody's talking about poutine, and it's just such a warm, comforting dish here in Montreal.
And La Banquise, the restaurant where you're speaking from, it has 28 types of poutine?
Yes, they've got more than two dozen types. It's unbelievable how crazy you can get with this dish. You know, some of the other entries, and actually outside of Banquise, there was a Japanese restaurant that entered a poutine served on top of an okonomiyaki, which is a seafood pancake as opposed to the French fries. The winner this year at La Poutine Week, the dish they had was kind of Indian inspired. They did a tikka masala, butter chicken, instead of this gravy. That was the gravy. It was kind of this Indian curry garam masala chicken-infused Indian dish on top of the fries with the cheese curd.
So what have you seen this week that should never be piled on top front of fries?
Well, there's a lot of people get a little crazy. I mean, I've seen things like you know, mashed potatoes, and I've seen vegetables, and I've seen, you know, people trying to gussy things up and make it more upmarket and put truffles on it, or maybe some foie gras, because you see foie gras everywhere in Montreal, the French influence here. And honestly, that's like gilding the lily. You don't need to put all the extra junk on top of this dish. I mean, like I said, the purists will say, give me cheese curds and give me gravy. But just because you can put stuff on top of fries and cheese curds doesn't mean you necessarily should.
Well said. Steve Dolinsky, enjoy that poutine at La Banquise, and we'll have a slideshow at PRI.org of all those delicious varieties. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup.
And finally today, fans of Iranian pop music got a big surprise on Valentine's Day. The Iranian diva Gugush released a music video in support of the gay and lesbian community. The video is getting a lot of attention from Iranians in and outside Iran. The World's Shireen Jafari has the story.
To understand why Gugush's latest music video is such a big deal for Iranians, you have to go back to pre-revolutionary Iran. In the late 1970s, when Americans were listening to Donna Summer, Gugush was stealing hearts in Iran. She was the icon. She had beauty and style. not to mention the voice. My mom played her music a lot when I was a kid. It was her favorite. She even had the Gugush haircut. But Gugush's stardom was cut short by the revolution in 1979. Iran banned women from singing publicly, so their beloved voice was silenced. Gugush stayed in Iran, occasionally singing for small private groups. She finally left in 2000 and performed a concert in Canada. You could say that was the start of part two of her career. Gugush is based in Los Angeles now, where she's been releasing albums. She's also started a TV show similar to American Idol. And now, the Valentine's Day video.
The video is about a love story between a girl and her partner.
Navid Akhavan wrote and directed Gugush's new video.
During the different situations of their life together, we also see that their love is not welcomed by society or by their family.
But then, at the very end,
we find out that the partner is a woman too.
Gugush is the first Iranian of her stature to support gay rights so publicly. So far, the video has more than 100,000 views on YouTube. And from the moment it was released, fans from all over the globe started to weigh in.
Oh, we got so many beautiful messages that it is difficult to point out one. But I read a message from a girl in Iran who said that this was the best gift she could get and that finally she feels like she does not have to be ashamed of being gay.
Not all the messages have been positive. I didn't expect this from you, one person wrote on Gugush's Facebook page. It's a disgrace. But Akhavan says he and Gugush have no regrets.
I think that it was time that a huge artist like Ms. Gugush would break the silence and break the taboo and open a dialogue about this matter within the Iranian society. I mean, not only inside, but also outside of Iran.
Akhavan says when someone like Gugush talks about freedom of love, everyone will hear it, whether they like it or not. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
You can see Gugush's new video on our website, PRI.org. That's it for us this week. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. The World is produced by Jeb Sharp and Clark Boyd, with Bradley Campbell, Andrea Crossan, Joyce Hackle, Shireen Jafari, David LaValle, Nina Porzuki, Tracy Tong, and Chris Wolf. April Peavy is our director. Our editors are William Troop, Jennifer Gorin, Aaron Schachter, Monica Campbell, David Barron, and Peter Thompson. Our managing editor is Jonathan Dyer. The executive producer of The World is Andrew Sussman. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at Carnegie.org, the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.